A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners. Ready? Welcome to this F1 news and debate show. I'm joined by an esteemed panel, highest of which is Matt Trumpet. Good evening, Matt.
And good afternoon to you, although I thought the chat room had insinuated itself ahead of me. Not that I remember such slights and insults for, you know, years and years and years on end.
Right. Okay. So people are only going to get that joke if they listen to our other live stream, Remain Indoors, the Remain Indoors podcast, which you definitely should. But we need to focus in on Formula One, Matt. And it's nice to get a bit of breathing space. We've had 6 races in like 2 weeks. So it's nice to actually sit and be able to talk about some news and stuff.
Yeah, it is. And I have to say, I woke up yesterday morning and found myself, instead of watching a race, driving my wife around for errands instead, and thought to myself, this seems actually odd at this point, because my life seems to have just simply been consumed by watching Formula One qualifying and races.
Yeah, and I've really been getting into watching all the practices, all the qualifying, all the build-up as well, and I really enjoyed when we did our patron-only live stream after FP2, and I was going to do it for Spa. I can't, because I'm being forced to go to a whole nother land, the Isle of Wight. I'm gonna put up my out-of-shed email replies. So we'll give it a miss this week. But after that, after Spa, what's the next race after Spa? Monza and then Mugello. So 2 races in Italy. We will do our patron-only live streams before then. Matt, we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Can you imagine not recording your podcast after a race? Can you imagine just waiting for like 5 or 6 days to put it out? Who would ever do such a thing? We've got 2 panelists for you. Firstly, fresh from racing at Silverstone in the Super GTs, it's Brad Philpott. Hi, Brad. How's it going, bud?
It's going really well. Good evening, guys. How you all doing?
It's great that you're the kind of modest guy that, you know, you're just there to compete. It's all about having fun. It's more fun if you win. You'd never turn up on a live stream with a gigantic trophy to your right-hand side.
I don't know what you're talking about. This is just my new beer glass that I'm drinking from.
Tell you what, we'll do a full catch-up with you, Brad, and find out how it all went at Silverstone. I watched it all live. I watched it go down. And also, you have a fantastic onboard live stream highlights clip of that as well. Rounding off our panel today is someone from another Formula One podcast. It's For F1's Sakes, Terry Saunders. Hello, Terry.
Hello, everybody. This is interesting, isn't it? I'm on a different podcast. It's like when Dylan went electric.
I think I might be too young for that reference.
Yeah, me too. It's one of those things you learn to say, but you don't know what it means.
Oh, is it Magic Roundabout? I don't know.
Yes.
Terry, it's not often I promote, support, or even acknowledge the existence of another podcast. But I have to say, here at Mist Apex, we are massive fans of what you guys do over there, especially the bit where you all do it in a pub.
Well, we did all do it in a pub before the pandemic, and now we're copying you on Skype. In fact, no, Zoom, Skype, I don't even know. We just sort of turn on whatever we're told to turn on. But it's not the same not being in a pub.
No. Yeah. I love you guys' approach to Formula One podcasting. Obviously, it's edited to death, which saves your inherent presenting and panelist flaws. But it's always a really kind of snappy... I've described it to people as like an F1 podcast pudding. So I say, listen to us first, get some like information, and then when you want like your sweets and desserts afterwards, go and listen to F1's sake.
Yeah, I think the way we can sell ourselves is saying that I'm not sure if any of us really like Formula One that much, so we can get quite angry about it. None of that love.
See, even though when you guys, you know, will occasionally not enjoy a race, and I get quite upset with people like jumping on the bandwagon and saying things are boring whenever there isn't a safety car or 8 crashes. But I think the difference with you guys is you don't do it in a joyless way. You still enjoy talking about it, and you enjoy, you know, it's a love to hate kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think it all comes from love. Like, we've all been watching Formula One for however many years. So, you know, we just want it to be good again or great again. Make Formula One great again.
Don't get any hats printed. Thank you very much, Terry Saunders, Brad Philpott, and Matt Trumpets. That is your panel for this week. Let's explore some big dirty news. Well, the biggest news of this week is that Williams have finally sold out. Matt Trumpets, Claire Williams said when they missed testing, it wasn't due to financial matters. They were never short of money. They never needed investment. And the last thing they were going to do is sell Williams F1 team. So either that was all rubbish, or this is literally the last throw of the dice and there was nothing else they could do. But that's it. Williams essentially, as an entity, is gone. All bar name?
Yep. The name will stay the same. The factory will stay the same. The management will stay mostly the same, one presumes. And she famously said on, I believe it was Drive to Survive, we will never be a B team. We will never sell out. But things change. You know, nobody sees this. No one expects this Spanish Inquisition, much less a pandemic. And they have sold out to a U.S. New York City-based investment hedge fund firm called Doralton, which sounds like a bag of potato chips to me, but it's called Doralton. And interestingly, I had wondered where this particular firm might have come across, oh, we should definitely buy a Formula One team. It turns out that their general counsel used to be general counsel for Pirelli. So it's possible that there was sort of, it's possible that Williams may have been working their networks and contacts looking for investors. And they decided that given the regulation change and the change in financial structure, that for the relatively bargain price of $179 million, that a Formula One team would be a good long-term investment. They do specialize in longer-term investments. They do work with management. They're not extract all the value and sell it off before it collapses kind of a firm.
What seemed interesting was that these guys came in, they've bought the company, but then they themselves are talking about looking for investment themselves to build and grow. But what is clear is that, you know, this is the end of, you know, Claire Williams and the Williams family being at the helm, even if they're still there with a management structure, not necessarily the same management structure. That mission is over. And this whole thing of saying we will never be a B team, it's not like cooking an egg. You can uncook a B team. You could have got into a big collaboration with a Mercedes or a Ferrari. And then when you felt confident, when you were back on your feet, you could have extracted yourself from that agreement. And I just feel, in fact, let's go over to Terry here. I don't know how you feel about this, but to me, it just feels like somehow that whole we are the Williams family pride has in the end perhaps done for them a bit.
Well, I mean, they can't hide from the results, can they? I mean, it's been woeful for however long. And, you know, the best thing about Williams has been for the last 10 years, they write off the car. We're focusing on next year's car. And every off season, all the fans go, oh, I really hope Williams do well. To the point that even the most ardent fans in the last few years
aren't coming into the season with any kind of hope. It's just, it's been quite sad. And, you know, it's good they've been bought out, I guess, to carry on. They're not going down the route of your Brabhams and your Tyrrells and just disappearing into history, but it's weird, isn't it? It's kind of sad. It's just, it's sad and slightly inevitable.
Yeah,
and it's not the way anyone wants to end it.
At some point, it's going to be Doritos F1, isn't it, Matt? Like, you know, it's paying lip service to the fans. It's understanding the history in F1, so you can't just come in and just run roughshod over it. But at some point, they're going to rename it.
I don't know if they're going to rename it. I've sort of had a brief look at their portfolio, and it does seem that their deal is to take an existing business and improve it. They're medium and long-term investments. They're not short-term pump-and-dump kind of firms, which I won't mention other Formula One associated names, but I'm sure we can all think of a few.
Janai.
Possibly, yes.
Is that one of the names you might have suggested? That wasn't a name I was suggesting for legal reasons.
Yeah, that would, you would have to talk to Carter about that, I believe.
Oh yeah, and we may will. Indeed. Yeah, so Carter will be on the Tuesday after Spa. That is the date we have agreed, and I think we're going to do a live stream at 5 p.m, which I believe is the 1st of September.
It sounds like fun, and I bet we'll get a lot deeper into the weeds. But what's interesting about this firm is I can see them taking a lot of things away from Williams on the business side, decision-making. But they do have an engineering portfolio and a fair number of engineers amongst their people in charge of stuff.
Yep.
So it's not a terrible, terrible fit. But as with everything Formula One, I'm sitting here asking myself, how do they really plan to make money? Because we all know the famous quote, how do you make $1 million in Formula One? Have $1 billion, buy a Formula One team.
All right, Terry. Well, is there hope, mate? Is there hope now that they've got some money, some investors, and it's not, you know, a family project? Could they possibly do any better?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Who knows anymore?
I don't think you've got the idea of being on a panel, Terry. You're meant to sort of give a strong opinion one way or the other.
I just can't have a strong opinion about Williams. I grew up in a time with Nigel Mansell and Williams, and, you know, this is the hero worshipping, and they've gone down so far that who knows? Yeah. I want them to do well.
Am I the only one who heard that response and thought Eeyore? You know, Christopher Robbins?
Oh, Eeyore.
Winnie the Pooh?
Oh, yes.
How are Williams going to
no.
do, Terry? I don't know. Maybe fine. Maybe fine. So we'll see how that shakes out. And go on, Terry, sorry.
I was going to say, well, they've been bought by this company called like Dorito Capital or whatever. It doesn't instill confidence, does it? Like, they could at least have renamed the holding company something like We Love Racing and We're In It for the Racing, not something Capital. I've watched Formula One for long enough to know that these people come in and they might do well, but I don't have a good feeling.
I would call myself Turbojet Holdings. And I think that would, people would be like, wow, they're super fast and turbo-y. And that would instill confidence. That's what I'd go for.
Yeah, or Go Faster. That could be the name. We've been bought out by Go Faster. So next year we're going to be faster.
Matt.
I think we'll really know who's in charge. Because if next year's livery features flames on the side, then you'll know the Americans are in charge for sure.
Exactly. And if the team gets a lot louder and more opinionated. Sorry, they're our biggest audience now, Matt. I can't slate you guys anymore. However, look, a little bit of hope for the Williams team. When we love Williams, of course, we all greatly admire the Williams family. But when you talk about an F1 team, it's not the monarchy that we're talking about. It's an institution as a whole. And the institution itself, I think, probably does have the potential to outgrow individuals or an individual family, and I gather they will still be involved. There's a whole team of people at Grove. There's a whole history of that organization, and when you walk into their facility, Matt, you're still going to see the trophies on the wall. You're still going to see Nigel and Damon. So I think the talk of Williams is dead, I think it's premature. That outfit still exists.
Yeah, what's dead is the idea that a family-owned Formula One team can compete and win races in this day and age. Yeah. And I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to be dead. There's a lot of things that we no longer expect. I did want to quickly mention, just quickly, for all the people who slate Claire Williams, there is the glass cliff to consider. And I think she did walk in at a terrible, terrible time. And it may be worth giving her a little bit of room to see what happens next.
Okay. You're saying that perhaps the glass ceiling of being a woman did hold her back in some way. I'm yet to see any kind of evidence of that. I think we can explore that at another time. I don't think that's the major contributing factor to why Williams has gone downhill, which we can explore. Brad?
I just wanted to say I don't really get the nostalgia because I grew up as a fan of Jordan, who have since been 15 different teams. And you know, it's still the same core team in the same factory, albeit I know they're building a new one, but things change. And if it's surely the staff would be happier being vaguely competitive and not worrying about their jobs every year because a bigger company is involved in the background rather than the fact that the same family are the ones making the decisions at the top. I'm just not really on board with the fact that, oh, you know, that the Williams heritage and Williams everyone's second favorite team or whatever, all that stuff people say is, I think, fund the thing properly and run it properly.
Yeah, exactly. The Spanish footballer Toro Rosso, central midfield for Real Madrid, he sold the team ages ago. It's still the same team, still the same spirit. All right, let's move on a little bit then. Let's discuss a tweet that was retweeted by our friend Othnell, who was pointing to a picture of Ayrton Senna driving his car around Monaco. Now, Brad, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, that famous qualifying session where Ayrton Senna was at the very limit of his car and he was saying, I was getting faster and faster every lap as the synergy between man and machine increased. You know, I'm of the opinion that that just meant you didn't get on the pace very quickly.
Yeah, this is really controversial, but I'm just going to say it anyway. In the spirit of having Terry on as a guest, I'm just going to be controversial and say that whole Senna, it was the perfect lap thing. I think the only difference between that and Hamilton saying, oh, I was so in the zone that I didn't realize it was the last lap, is time and the fact that most of the other drivers weren't as good back then. Like, I think that's really the only difference. I think Senna was really good. I don't think he was on some other plane that the really good drivers now aren't on. I just think it's a massive amount of hype, that whole thing.
If we're going to talk about laps like that, can I bring up the lap that Lewis Hamilton drove in the wet, dry conditions at Spa, where he thought he was way behind Vettel and just kept on going faster and faster and faster, but it turned out his dash was displaying the wrong number, and he wound up taking qualifying by like well over a second. When they asked Vettel about it, because everyone had thought he won, he goes, well, I guess I could have gone faster after all, which struck me as hilarious.
Yeah. So the reason, though, I'm bringing up that particular bit of footage, Brad, is because in the comments, people were really going, oh, look, you know, that's when it was really properly hard to drive an F1 car. That's when men were men. Oh, listen, look, we made it too easy. Now a 5-year-old can drive an F1 car. But, you know, the question Othnell posed on his Twitter was, is this just down to camera angles, video stabilization, and such like? And I know, Terry, you did somewhat of a rigorous scientific peer-reviewed double-blind test as to whether it is the difference between car performance or just camera technology.
That's right, yeah. I went around Morrison's car park in a trolley with a GoPro sellotape to the front, and honestly, that looks about as scary as Ayrton Senna's Monaco lap. So I don't think it's to do with skill or anything. I think it proves definitively that McLaren handled like a shopping trolley, and that's why it's so scary to look at.
So I haven't seen the footage of your shopping trolley. I'm assuming that it... Did you turn the video stabilization off?
Yep. It was raw as it would be, and it was quite scary. Shopping trolleys can go quite fast when you're being pushed by a bloke. It was genuinely terrifying.
I think most students know that. Yeah. Did you really turn the video stabilization off, or are you only now realizing in this conversation that would have been a good idea or was even a thing, and now you're too embarrassed so you just said that you did it?
I honestly have no idea. There was a camera guy who was in charge of all that, but I reckon it sounds more impressive to say it was off.
What do you think?
That's the way I roll.
What do you think? There's got to be an element of it. I know you're a broadcasty person. Sometimes you look at this old footage and you just go, well, yeah, of course it looks better now because, you know, you can go to the shops, get a 200 quid GoPro, turn on video stabilization, and suddenly, you know, everything looks that little bit smoother.
Yeah, but I just have this issue with the thing is... It's not just nostalgic saying it looked better in the old days, but it did look better in the old days because the quality is better now, but it just looks safer and, you know, it looks more saturated. And like that end center in Monaco, like the camera keeps cutting out and it looks like it's cutting out because the camera's shutting its eyes because it's too scared. It's just going, I don't want to go this fast, mate. Can you stop? And I think we've lost a bit of the rawness. And it's not even just the cameras. Formula One cars in those days, you felt like they were going to fall apart. They were on the edge of falling apart at any moment, which kind of made it, that's why there's more retirements, there's less reliability. Whereas now everything just feels a bit too, you know, everything's data driven to the last degree. And, you know,
yeah,
a car doesn't blow up. They just kind of go, oh, the engine's getting a bit hot. You better pit and retire. It's like, well, just let it go until it blows up.
No, that's why you're not an accountant at an F1 team, Terry, I'd imagine.
They've got lots of money. They're fine.
One good example is when you look at old footage and you look at the camera angles, sometimes the camera will just like be tracking a car and there's like a floodlight in front of it, you know, or a bit of fencing, or it follows the action and there's spectators in front. And you have to think that actually just the general standard of TV viewing, TV broadcasting has improved to the point where, you know, they would never allow an obscured shot. But in the olden days, like at Monaco, you know, they're like on a yacht or something and you're seeing, you know, masts of boats and bikinis and pants being thrown in the air in front of it. And that all makes it look a bit quicker and a bit faster because the camera guy's not quite as skilled. The technology's not quite as good.
Yeah, and the cameras would have been much heavier in those days. It also makes it feel like you're a spectator watching the race through the telly, whereas now it feels like it's this big bland show where every camera, you get all the camera angles, I've got a big bugbear about all the weird like wide shots that make the cars look really slow, like that one where the cars come from a distance towards the camera and they just look like they're going at 10 miles an hour. And like, you know, like the Indy 500s on at the minute and they have good camera shots where the cars look quick and the speed difference isn't that huge between Formula 1 and Indy, but at Indy the TV coverage looks quicker.
So, Brad Philpott, you were racing for in your Lotus, Avon Tyres branded Lotus at Silverstone yesterday in a Super GT class. And from the Alpha TV coverage, which in fair play was great and the commentators were very entertaining, it didn't look that fast coming down hangar straight. On your onboard, it looked like the maddest experience ever.
That's the example I just wanted to raise, actually. I obviously hadn't seen the outside shots whilst I was in the race and it felt really fast. Finished the race and my brother messaged me and said something like, that wasn't very fast, was it? And in the interview, you said that they were pulling away like 100 meters from you on the straight. And I watched the video and they were like 5 car lengths. So I sent him some onboard footage and sent him, I showed him like the 100 meter gap between the cars down the straights. And he was like, oh, didn't look like that offboard. And I watched it back and exactly that shot Terry was talking about, the hangar straight, or was it you? I can't remember which one of you just said this, the hangar straight shot, where the cars are coming towards you, it really shortens the gaps and makes them look like they're going super slow. And that's obviously way worse in a car which isn't a Formula One car. I think there's a lot to be said for the right kind of camera angles to make it look faster.
I wonder, Terry, though, because I think they want to capture the action now. You know, they want you to see it, everything from a sporting point of view, which I kind of agree with. I don't want to miss any action. I want to see the context of the car in the background. But a lot of times you have like a long lingering shot of Lewis Hamilton's Mercedes for 20 seconds coming down the straight and it doesn't move much in the screen. It just gets slightly bigger as it comes towards you. Whereas in the olden days, you know, they'd be following it through the hangar straight, trying to zoom in, missing it.
Exactly. And just, and it's that feeling of like, it's so fast. You know, if you're trying to like, with a pair of binoculars or a camera, trying to take a picture of a plane and it's zoomed in all the way and it takes ages to find it. That is what we wanted to look at. Because it looks like they're going, this car's going so fast, I can't even find it. But no, instead we have it all. And then they do the other thing I hate, which is that slow-mo shot. Like, let's see all the bits of wing wobble about on a curb for 20 minutes. I don't want to see it all slow.
And the thing is, Matt, that always makes you panic because it's like slow motion replay of Lewis Hamilton in the lead and you go, oh God, oh no, what's happened now?
To be fair, I would watch for days the tire wobble induced by the curbs at slow motion. But I recognize I am not the average F1 viewer. So fair enough. It amazes me, given how much everybody knows about how much cinematographers know, how much their directors, that they still seem to have trouble at certain tracks establishing angles that communicate how rapidly these cars are going, because they are so much faster than anything else that's on that track. It's not even funny. Did you see, Brad, there was a comparison of an F1, F2, and F3 car at Barcelona. Someone started their lap at the same time and let them play out. It's insane.
I haven't seen that, But what I wanted to do was just throw in a few more reasons why this phenomenon we're talking about might be a thing. And so I think we've covered the camera angles one. I also think the fact that the cars, I mean, there's a few. The cars were definitely more dangerous. The runoff areas simply weren't as big. And the things that you were going to run into were less nice. You know, it was gravel, barriers, spectators, metal fences, that kind of thing. So it looked more dangerous. And we've mentioned the cars actually were harder to drive, as in physically harder. You're having to manually change gear. So the drivers, like in that Senna video, are letting go of the steering wheel, which the car didn't have power steering anyway, and they're having to change gear manually. They've also got a car which isn't as planted. You know, you've still got very, very powerful engines, and in some cases as powerful or similar to kind of modern standards, but cars which have way less grip. You know, tire technology has moved on a lot in 20, 25, 30 years. Obviously, we know there's a lot less downforce. So physically, the cars were also harder to drive. The next thing from that, though, is we can also then talk about how hard the competition is today.
Yeah.
Because I think it's just, we're kind of comparing quite different things. I don't watch Formula One today necessarily because the cars are difficult to get around the circuit. But I watch because I want to see the best people do that.
It's like saying that the 1966 England squad was better than, you know, the current squad because they had to kick much heavier and harder balls and they had to head, you know, rocks of footballs and they had to do it in like boots that came up to your ankle and the pitches weren't as good. So just because it may have been physically more demanding in some areas, it doesn't mean necessarily that it's easier to become a football player now than it was when it was physically tougher. But also, we can't mitigate that modern footballers and modern F1 drivers are not only more physically fit, Brad, but they've also come through probably a higher level of competition as well. So it's a different challenge just because you don't have to change gears one-handed. It's still, I don't know, I don't like it when people kind of go, oh, well, it was much harder back in the olden days.
Yeah, it's just very different. The clearest example for me is it would be absolutely unthinkable today for a driver to rock up in their 30s and then, you know, have a go and then win the world championship like a Damon Hill. Like, you just wouldn't do that because everyone's too good. You need to have been, you can't kind of go through your teenage years being a little bit interested in motorsport, do some motorbike racing in your 20s, maybe get into car. You will not be good enough to race in Formula One. You know, regardless of like Lance Strolls and those kind of people, they're way better than a person who decides to do it in their late 20s. So the standard is just that much higher.
I don't know if I don't know if how far we want to go down this particular rat hole of was F1 easier before or after. But I did see an interesting tweet that came our way about Max Verstappen. Now, Terry, I'm sure you'll remember when Verstappen came into the sport at 12, 13, 17. I think he was 17 years old.
A fetus, I think.
So obviously at that time, this argument really took a big shove forward because everyone was going, oh, well, look, you know, if a 17-year-old can drive an F1 car, how hard can it be? And, you know, could it just be, the argument might go, could it just be that actually he was just something a little bit special? So the tweet that came our way was, can you discuss the overhype of Max Verstappen and also discuss the mess that is AWS? Yeah, we'll get to AWS. Yeah, I think so. So Matt coming first, then Brad, then Terry.
If an 8-year-old can play the Rachmaninoff piano concerto, how hard could it possibly be? Yeah, there are always people who are special. And yeah, I think we can say Verstappen is pretty special at this point in terms of his ability to drive a car. But it's a ridiculous argument. The speed at which they drive and the physical strain placed on their body has no comparable in previous iterations of the sport. The amount of G's that they have to sustain and the speed of the reaction time required, especially in qualifying, there's nothing that compares to it because the cars were never even close to that fast.
See, I think of this as the opposite way around. Someone using the argument you used, you know, if a 17-year-old can do it, how hard can it be? Surely the correct wording is, if someone who's done it since they were 4 years old at an extremely high world-class level and is at their peak physical fitness can do it, how hard can it be? It's like, that's the perfect time to do it if you've been preparing for it as like your life goal from a crazy young age. The flip side would be if if a 30-year-old can do it, how hard can it be? Like, surely that's the more reasonable argument.
So a few people are going to pick up on this and say, you know, when I said that the cameramen are better now than before, I'm not meaning to disparage cameramen from the 70s or the 60s or any sportsman, but it's just hard to look at any elite field, any top class field, where the standard hasn't improved in the last 30 years. And to hear anybody claim that Formula One is somehow immune to that, that always baffles me. Of course the modern drivers are at a higher standard and a higher level of competition. That doesn't diminish what they achieved in their time, the Sennas and the Prosts and alike. It's just a fact of elite and popular things that demand increases, competition increases and such like. But let's discuss the Max Verstappen phenomenon. Let's go to our guest, Terry Saunders. You are arguably the third highest ranking member of F1 Sake podcast. Is that fair? It's Cheeky, the host. Phil seems to know all the things. And in fact, your producers, you're probably fourth, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I'm fifth because the cat sometimes comes in, so it's fine. Yeah. You know, I'm just there at the end to make sense and make things funny. But I think the Max Verstappen thing, my issue with him is I don't think we can really count him as a driver. I think he's more of a science experiment for what would happen if two racing drivers had a baby and then they put the baby into a go-kart, like straight from the womb. And then he just drove around a track 15 years and then got into Formula One. It's like an 80s sci-fi film. It should be like Kelly LeBrock's going to come out instead of Max Verstappen. Is this going to be the future now? We're just going to have racing drivers doing it to make new racing drivers, and all racing drivers are going to be offspring of other racing drivers, and it's going to be like the monarchy. It's going to have like Nico Rosberg's baby.
I don't know. Go on, Brad.
Sorry, Spanish. You're going to have to beat that because that word isn't, that name isn't broadcastable in Terry's world.
Yeah, I said the name. Yeah. Although, well, this is the thing. This is the danger with a podcast that goes on for a while where you have this long running joke. So the joke was that we didn't like Nico Rosberg, him. I've said the name again. That guy, the guy that won the 2016 championship.
Yeah.
And we didn't like him. So we said we're never going to mention his name again. And if we do mention it, it gets beeped out. But obviously, he's been gone for a few years. We've got new podcast listeners, and then he was on the coverage for the race last week, and then we're all beeping him out, and then everyone tweets going, who are you beeping out? We don't understand the joke. It's like we've gone too far back around, and now no one understands who we're beeping out or why.
Matt does that to me all the time. Matt will make a reference to something 4 years ago, go, do you get it? I'm like, no, I've slept 1,000 times since then.
Yeah, you are remarkably entertainingly difficult at picking up on the occasional references to things that I think everybody should know. Okay. Don't know why.
Well, because I've never knowingly podcasted sober. That might be part of the reason. But interesting point there where you're talking about the sons of F1 drivers. Normally, Terry, I have argued that the protege of F1 drivers can get so far, but very rarely get to that top ever level, because Nico Rosberg, as good as he was, and as fast as he was in a selection pool of one, because Keke Rosberg was always going to put him in the position in Monaco in karts, put him in the best gear, have people test his engines for him. He was always going to get into the right place at the right time and be generally well prepared for racing. Lewis Hamilton, on the other hand, came through a selection pool of thousands of karters and then had to go all through those ranks looking for funding, was able to get funding with McLaren. So someone who's come through that selection pool was always going to have an advantage over Rosberg for the ultimate kind of top tier. Whereas with Max Verstappen, though, I think that's starting to ruin my argument, because he does look like he might have that last few tenths.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that Rosberg actually got a Formula One drive before Lewis did.
Mm.
And what strikes me about your argument, as correct as it is on so many levels, is what having a parent who is a Formula One driver really guarantees you is the absolute best connections and training. And that where that person winds up is then kind of going to be down to their talent. But you have to recognize how many obstacles get removed from their path, especially in the early days.
I'm obviously totally speculating here, but I think maybe what comes into it in Max's example is that his dad wasn't particularly successful You know, he got to drive in one of the top teams. He drove for Benetton alongside Schumacher. And so he was kind of nearly there, but he never actually achieved the final thing. And it feels like he's had it drilled into him from a very young age that, like, this desire to go the next step and do it. And Max has some kind of, I'm sure the Dutch listeners will love me for this, but Max has some kind of additional killer, like, desire to just be the fastest and be the best. And I think he's probably always had that from a young age. I think in some aspects of his personality, it was probably detrimental and socially, but in terms of racing, it means he's really, really fast.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say we're only talking in terms of its effect on your racing performance and not on you as a complete and total human being. But what's interesting to me is it sounds like what you're saying, Brad, is that essentially Max learned every lesson that his dad learned the hard way before he ever lost anything from it.
Mm.
And what strikes me about Rosberg is interesting is that Rosberg's dad won one championship. But when he won that one championship, he either won only one race that season or none at all, whereas Rosberg won several. So we can still see that there was an incremental improvement from generation.
I've been massively put off by our live chat stream. You can join us there and watch us record this live and chat along live on YouTube. Search for Missed Apex Podcast on there or follow our feeds on Twitter at Missed Apex F1. And each show now has a scheduled live stream. So you can go find those scheduled live streams and set a reminder for you to come and join in. Matt Stone has just completely put me off. I'll somewhat curtail this. It's a good thing Jensen has been around the block a little bit in his younger days, because there's going to be lots of a big generation of F1 Brits coming in soon. Yeah, there's going to be like, maybe like 20, a whole grid of Jensen Button looking like drivers in the next, what do you reckon, in the next 13 to 14 years? Yeah, there we go. It could be that. All right, moving on. So then, the F1 calendar has been somewhat, you know, hit and miss with the reports of what tracks are going to be coming up next. We kind of lost sight of the whole argument of how many races will there be? How will we know when the season's going to end? We lost sight of all that because they announced, you know, 6 dates, 9 dates, and we were all just happy to get our F1 fix. Now there are rumors coming out. It hasn't been officially announced yet, but as is typical for a podcast, I'm assuming it will be announced on the Monday morning that this comes out, that there's going to be a 17-race season. Hearing lots of things, hearing that it's going to be a double header, a triple header with Turkey, Bahrain, and then Abu Dhabi. And 17 races in total. But the one that everybody has been getting most excited about is Istanbul. Everyone for years, every single time we've talked about the tracks we should go back to, the best tracks in F1, Istanbul comes up time and time again. And I'll put this to you, Terry. I cannot wait for that first Turkish Grand Prix back to have no safety cars, Lewis Hamilton to win it, and for everyone to say it's boring and terrible and we should now burn it.
Well, it's just about turn 8, isn't it? Everyone goes crazy about turn 8. I can't even remember what other turns there are in that track. It's all we do is talk about turn 8. They should just dig up turn 8 and put it in Silverstone or something. Then we're all happy.
Well, why don't we put it in America? We could just lift it, maybe flip it over and put it, you know, somewhere in the south of America.
Great.
Austin, Cota. That was a Cota reference, Brad.
So just because the unwashed masses go on about turn 8 doesn't mean that that's all that there is about this track. This is a really good track for loads of other reasons. In fact, turn 8, it's the thing that people talk about, that's actually probably the worst corner on the track in terms of racing. That's the one corner that stops close racing, because obviously it's a long, fast corner. But there's loads of other corners that are really conducive to racing, like long straights followed by tight bits. And so the reason this track's interesting is because it's got good elevation change, it's quite long, it's got some interesting features like turn 8, but it's also got the things you need for good racing, which is the long flat out sections and then a tight switchback. So, and occasionally animals that just run on the track, if you ever watched the GP2 races back in the day. But this will be a good track for racing. And if anyone hasn't watched races at Istanbul, any new fans, search on YouTube for Lewis Hamilton in GP2, where he comes through the field after spinning right at the start of the race. You'll see a lot of overtakes and you'll see why this is a good track for racing.
Well, I think my favorite memory of Turkey has to be the Red Bull drama between Sebastian Vettel and Mark Webber, where Vettel thought that Webber was just going to get out of his way for reasons. And Webber, remarkably, didn't agree, and they just hit each other. And it was the start that eventually led to the Multi 21 thing and all the other stuff. But it was it has long put up dramatic races in Formula One, and it'll be very exciting. If they confirm that, it's a 17 race calendar for us that ends December 13 in everybody's favorite venue, I think, Abu Dhabi.
See, I don't even mind Abu Dhabi. I don't think it's as bad a choice. I know I get yelled at every time I say that, and you can yell at me, spannersready@gmail.com, or get in touch with Matt, because I'm going to be off on my holidays all of next week. So you can email Matt at mattpt50. Sorry, that's not how emails work. mattpt55@gmail.com. And I'll be redirecting everyone to you, Matt. So everyone who sort of emails in to call me a poopy head, I'm going to send them all your way.
Yeah, just out of office and forward. That's fine.
Okay, good. I'll do that. Here's my biggest concern with Istanbul is because I do genuinely love that track. I'm not as anti all the tilkadromes as some other people, perhaps, because, you know, I've seen how the classic tracks have kind of choked F1 with these modern cars. So I've got good memories of the Turkish Grand Prix. What's happened recently in the last few years, as I'm sure some people and some iTunes reviewers are keen to point out to me that they're sick of, as I've pointed out, is that I enjoy a race. Not every race is going to kick off. I go online and everybody's just saying it's terrible. And Terry, you're not shy to say if a race didn't kick off or a race was terrible. I am scared, though, that with all this hype, as soon as the race is over, if it's not a thriller, I just need to hide from social media because everybody's just going to go, ah, the Turkish Grand Prix is terrible now.
I mean, well, it's likely to be a Mercedes 1-2 or the new normal, a Mercedes 1-3 because Verstappen's crept into 2, yeah. But yeah, well, maybe the thing is, it's just been a nice thing this year of having some different tracks again, isn't it? I mean, I know that logistically we can't do this for the future, but it should be more of a lottery of, you know, there'd just be a big tombola at the start of the season and they pull out the tracks that are going to be in the championship and not have all 30 of them.
I realize I am skipping to another topic, but au contraire, we might very well be doing this in the future because it seems like between our friend Joe Sayward and our friend Matthew Carter, that it's looking like, at least by the time we get to 2022, a 25 race calendar is going to be pretty much standard operating procedure for Formula One. And that's not going to happen without more tracks.
I had a question about Istanbul in particular. I was under the impression it was in disrepair and that it wasn't being used for any other racing after Formula One didn't go back there. It happens with a lot of tracks. You know, if the race isn't due to continue, then the track doesn't get used, especially if it's a country where there isn't a strong national motorsport scene. And so does anybody know how much work there is to be done to get it back up to standard so Formula One can visit?
Well, I'd say it'd be better if they keep it in a state of disrepair. That'll make the race more exciting.
Yeah, so they're like just whipping through like overgrown forests and overgrown jungles. I've got my own suggestion. I was, in another life, I was a United Nations troop person in the neutral zone between Turkish Northern Cyprus and the Greek Cypriots. So in the 1970s, the Turkish army advanced on Northern Cyprus. This gets interesting, I swear. And they stopped. They stopped the fighting at one point with, at the narrowest points, like a half a mile to a 2 mile gap. All the houses and towns in the middle just got left. As part of the UN mandate, you couldn't move anything. So there was like abandoned cars, abandoned houses, and nature just came back in and took it all over. So if that's the Turkish Grand Prix, my suggestion, Terry, would be simple. Just get a bunch of squaddies and tell them that when they finish doing that, they can knock off for the weekend. They'll get it done in half an hour. It'll be done. Easy.
Sounds good. Or make the drivers do it. It's like an old Le Mans start. Instead of jumping in the car, they have to cut all the trees down first.
Anyone who stands up during the ceremony at the beginning of the Grand Prix has to do it.
Okay, look, let's take a quick diversion and then talk about that. Terry, as a fellow podcaster and a podcaster who is this fair, Terry, you don't really mind if someone is disagrees with you or is offended by you. You just, you want to say what you want to say. Obviously, in this industry now. Yeah, go on.
I'd say I actively encourage it. I'd quite like it when, you know, I think, especially with an important subject like with the Black Lives Matter movement and everything, it's tricky in a podcasting, let's face it, it's a very white male world. Mm. Formula One is a very white male world. And I think it would be better if there was more diversity in all of this. But actually, if we can just take a little moment, you know, if I can use my tiny platform to highlight some injustices and have a go at the racists, then if they don't want to listen to me anymore, then they can nearly do a swear word that I didn't do there. Look, I'm good. Oh, see, nearly.
You're growing, Terry. That's growth.
I am always astonished how being against racism and Nazis will garner you bad reviews and people no longer listening to you. I don't know. I'm a bit older than I suspect the rest of you are, but my gramps fought in World War II. And I just sort of grew up with the idea that these sorts of things were bad and we should be against them on general principle. So I'm amazed that you could point out some things and say that we should do better because we can. And then people would be like, no, we shouldn't do better. We should do the opposite of better. We should do worse because you're a terrible person. And here I'm going to personally try and ruin you just because you have a thought or an opinion.
Well, there you go, Terry. Cancel culture. People tried to cancel you on iTunes after you said your piece. Let's have a look. Let's read these reviews. 1-star reviews. I get them too. Ashwoodjish on says a promising start, but then disappointing. I was looking for a new podcast and initially thought I'd found it until the last 3 minutes when they insisted on telling all their listeners that they either agree with Black Lives Matter or they are racist and should unsubscribe. Did you literally say you're racist and should unsubscribe?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I mean, maybe I should have said racist and unsubscribe and please leave a sarky review on the way out, you know, because I've hurt your feelings because you're racist. And that guy, you know, I don't want those people listening to my podcast. So good riddance.
Fair enough. And we've had an influx of 1-star reviews as well. So I thought we might take a minute to, firstly, thank the people who have sent us great iTunes reviews. We've got 40 in 1 week at the beginning of the season. So thank you very much for that. It really, really does help. I had Nathan tell me that it's a potential to be a good podcast. This is about us, Terry. Potential to be a good podcast, but the host is too annoying. If they got a new host, it would be worth listening to. Matt is good, though. So there's a vote of confidence for Matt, at least. There's one person loved Matt. Should we do another for F1's sake one?
Yeah, go on.
I like these. Here we go. The last episode was terrible, except Chica, who held it together. That's good. Thanks, Goon RV.
I can't remember what there was a specific thing for that. I can't remember what it was, but I think all three of us had something going on that week. I think we were all in a rubbish mood, and I think it was a boring race as well. So I think that is one bad review I'd accept because Chica did hold it together and it was a bad episode. So good on him. But that guy's probably racist as well.
Yeah, terrible. Right, okay. And then we had could be a good show, but too much swearing and profanity. Shame. That's a conscious decision though, isn't it, Terry, when you decide your podcast?
Sorry, was that a review for you?
No, that was a review for you. We we never say any naughty words.
Well, do you know, we do less naughty words than we used to. We're working on a quota system now. It's like fishing in international waters. So, you know, I'm allowed one bad word and some others, but I can't talk about on this one. But no, I think swearing's fine. And if I'm going to get angry and talk about something, I'm going to swear. And if you don't want to listen to swearing, then I'll put everyone forward for Missed Apex podcast, which is a lovely podcast.
Oh.
But, you know, it has the potential to be a lovely podcast. Is that right?
Brad.
So that was me that left that review. I'm trying to remember what I wrote. Yeah.
Brad.
I just really enjoy when I listen to that other podcast and they mention us as like this kind of goody two-shoes one. It's just a really funny dynamic.
So, Terry, like lots of people assume that we hate each other mainly because you make a habit of just slagging us off on your show.
I think it's done with affection, isn't it? I think people see that I don't really hate you. I think we're just jealous of your success. And what's the best way to combat jealousy? It's to snide and be nasty.
God,
that's
yes, no.
Is work.
It is so much easier to bring people down to your level than to climb up to meet them. Absolutely. Brad.
Yeah, yeah.
You should have heard what Spanners were saying about you when you guys appeared on the first page of iTunes. Oh, my God.
I wasn't happy. I was
well, what can we?
So last one before we move on. This is from Captain Wibberley, who the title of this review is, well, it's not for F1's sake. Still 5 stars. A brilliant show. Love catching this every week. Can't believe they went through all that lockdown with great content and no races. They religiously stick to their 1 hour show each week. Thank you very much. And I know that this section will really, really annoy the person who left us a review that said they spend too much time promoting themselves and being self-referential. All right, then. Let's move on to more kind of F1 podcasty topics, Matt. I think that would be a good idea. And then that iTunes review guy will be happy. There's some F1 news. In fact, whilst we've been recording this, the Indy 500 has been running. And I think we're not going to do any spoilers for that because Brad is absolutely going apoplectic. He's lifted his headphones off. Don't worry. We're not doing any spoilers for anything that happened in the race. But Terry, interesting, they've gone in a different direction to Formula One with the head safety. I'm a massive, massive fan of having a little bit of protection for the head. We've already seen a couple of incidents where a tire's gone to encroach the cockpit area and the halo. We don't know what would have happened if the halo had not been there. Indy's gone a different way. Indy's gone with a much, much uglier version. So basically, you know, do you have a screen in front of you? At which point you may as well have a roof as well. Or do you have the halo? Now, personally, I think the halo, once you got used to that initial shock, it was like 2014. Do you remember when all the fronts of the cars all looked like Ann Summers devices? But then after race two, they looked fine.
They didn't. They did. No, they did not look fine. They looked ridiculous for the whole year and nobody liked it. And anyone who says that is lying. I'm going to leave a review.
A bad review about it. Yeah. Incorrectly identifies the aesthetics of cars. Which way would you have gone? Which do you prefer, seeing that IndyCar's gone full aero screen path?
Hey, folks. I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, I just feel like they've done it wrong. It's like it looks really like the screen. Like, you know, we saw the like Red Bull did a test of the aero screen like years ago before the halo came out, and it was a slick swept back thing, and it looked like it was going to be quite cool. And this, it just looks like, you know, in this age of COVID, and you go into a shop or a garage and they've put big Perspex screens up in front of the till. That's what they've done on the Indy cars. They've just put a Perspex screen up in front of the till. It doesn't look slick or like a racing car at all. It just looks like they've gone, yeah, there's some tarpaulin, wrap it around the car.
Do you know what it looks like to me? And I don't want anyone to think that I'm just slating Indy for the sake of it. I'm not, I promise. It looked a little bit like a character out of the Disney Pixar Cars. As soon as they put that screen up, you know, you could draw two little eyes on it and that would be the character Speedy McCarvisor. Brad?
I actually think those aero screens are the Red Bull ones. I think Red Bull have developed them and produced them for them. So they've probably just had to make them more actually effective rather than sleek and cool looking, which is originally, I think they were bouncing the tires up into the air when they were fired at them and that kind of thing. So they weren't safe for spectators.
if you're going to use data and science, then I'm not going to win, am I? But no, you're right. I mean, yeah, it's an evolution of that one, but it did used to look better, I reckon, in the when it didn't work as well, but it definitely looked better.
I also have another opinion on this, because a lot of people bring up the argument that you can't see the drivers when you've got the screen, and you know, you can't see the driver working. And I just want to, like, you know, cut that one off early on, because I just today I was watching British Touring Cars, and you also can't see the drivers in there, but it's amazing because, like, the cameras can go inside the car and then you can see the driver anyway, and the commentators still amazingly knew which car was which. So I don't really subscribe to that argument either.
Well, what a surprise. Aging GT driver Bradley Philpott wants to defend GT cars. Sorry, I didn't mean that. That was mean. Although it is fair, because I just saw Brad shuffle his trophy closer to the camera. Don't think I didn't notice that you did, that. That's fantastic. Matt.
Right. So they are the Red Bull Aero screens. And the reason why they don't always look good from every angle is, unlike the Halo, which slopes down to the cockpit, they sort of establish a straight line from where the Aero screen is at its height all the way back. And the reason they do that is exactly why Terry mentions science and data. Those Aero screens have already prevented some potentially very serious injuries, even in just this year. I think the jet fighter cockpit is where Formula One will probably eventually wind up, for the following reason: that outside of large objects, meaning tires, there's only a 17% chance that the Halo will prevent injury from smaller bits of debris impacting a driver's head. Sooner or later, that will be a problem, and they will solve it with an Aero screen type device.
And actually, I think what they should do is go for the full canopy and make it super strong, and then take off the helmets so we can see their faces. Imagine if it was racing without helmets on, and you could just see how terrified, like, you know, Lance Stroll looks.
Well, look, I don't want to tell tales on Brad. Brad, you're obviously a GT driver, a Nürburgring specialist, so you are driving these kind of cars that Terry's talking about, and I personally hope that in the future you will graduate to much faster versions of those cars. However, would you, as Terry says, would you pull your helmet off and have a race around?
So it's actually a really interesting question, because probably no, but also I've worked at race circuits. You know, for over a decade, I worked at a racetrack where you had to deliver the cars to and from each of the various tracks that we had on site that were used for different types of cars. You had to get them from the workshop to there and back. And that was a couple of times per day, because you had to go at lunchtime and you had to come back for lunch and you had to bring them back at the end of the day. And with sort of 10 instructors on each event, most people wouldn't bother necessarily putting their helmets on when you did that. Mm. And you kind of, like, didn't even really put the seatbelts on, but you wanted to get back for lunch as quick as possible. So I have had that experience of driving quite quick on a track without the safety devices. And it isn't particularly pleasant, really. No. So I probably wouldn't do that in a competitive situation.
So what about then Charles Leclerc doing a lap in the end without his seatbelt on, Brad? That to me seems terrifying, because I'm guessing even when they just lift off the accelerator, the seatbelt is taking a lot of their weight.
Yeah, that was a really crazy thing to happen, wasn't it? I don't know why he did that, because at the point where the only time where I would generally personally consider doing a thing that's a bit reckless like that normally is if there's something really big to lose. You know, yeah, you're in a race winning position. I've been on my way around the Nordschleife in, you know, a championship winning position in a race car when my seatbelt has just pinged off, you know, flat out around the Nürburgring, and suddenly the seatbelt is off. And I've had to say to the team on the radio, guys, we're going to have to pit this lap because I really need you to reapply my seatbelts. But you don't actually slow down on that lap, even though it's obviously very, very dangerous, because you don't want to lose the race. And the only thing you can do is to get back to the pits, pit a couple of laps early and reapply them. However, Charles Leclerc had been sat at the side of the track for ages, was in a rubbish position even before the car decided to give up. I just don't understand why you would, in that position, risk not just driving straight back into the pits. All I can think is he kind of was distracted just by the fact that the car suddenly started up again and he wasn't expecting it, and he didn't think to cross across the track into the pits.
Now, I don't mean to brag about my extensive experience in race cars.
Oh, my God.
But I have been in at least one, and the belts are kind of different to what most people use in their road cars. I do wonder if he didn't hit the button to get out, and then the car started up, and he literally didn't remember that he'd unlocked the belt and drove off, and only realized they were loose the first time he took his foot off the accelerator, and he just slid forward and hit the steering wheel with his chest, which is, I assume, what would pretty much happen, even if you didn't use the brakes going around there. But I don't know when he became aware of it. I was going to go back and try and watch the onboards, but being an old guy, I just plain old forgot.
No, I've only been in a GT car racing strap once as well, and I was really surprised with how restrictive it is. Like, you genuinely can't move. And I said to the guys, you know, guys, I've got kind of short legs here. You know, can we shuffle the seat forward? And I was there thinking, you know, there's a lever underneath. We could just shimmy it forward. And they just laughed because they were like, no, that would take forever. Good luck. And I'm like reaching for the pedals with the tips of my toes. Terry, what are the seatbelts like in Morrison's shopping trolleys?
Well, there's no seatbelts. You just got to weigh yourself down with the shopping.
Right.
And maybe a bag for life or two. Just tied to the straps and just hold on to them for dear life.
Brilliant. Let's end with some actual news. Matt Trumpets, we've got an agreement. We have a thingy. There has been an F1 accord, and everyone has now agreed what is best for Formula One going forward.
Yes, despite all of the potential drama, all of the teams have re-upped with the Concord agreement. We know that the finance and the payouts have been restructured because it was mentioned by Gunther Steiner in an interview with Haas. And that this might not only have been the reason that Williams wound up being sold, because the potential investors saw value there going forward with a new structure of payments, but it might also have been crucial for Haas not simply bailing at the end of this year and either selling off to the highest bidder or simply wrapping up operations altogether. So it's a good thing. I believe there's an opt-out clause so that if teams are unhappy once a year, they have the opportunity to bail on the sport. But on the whole, it's what Formula One needed, especially in this particular moment, to establish a firm footing going forward to remain a solvent and potentially lucrative sport for all those involved.
What concerns me about this is that we've almost got I think in all but name, we've basically got a franchise sport here where there's no real prospect of a team suddenly appearing and entering into F1. And I think as long as we've got this kind of Concord agreement where all the teams have to agree for it to become a thing. It seems absolute madness to me, Terry. Like, the, you know, can you imagine the Football League if all the team, I don't know if there is a system like this, if all the teams had to agree in the Premiership and, you know, they removed promotion relegation because they would only agree to terms that kept them viable. I would much prefer a system where we had the governing body is the sport, and you are allowed to just enter the sport. And if you're good enough, if you can do it within the rules the sport lays out, then good on you. These guys, I don't know, it just feels like the teams have way too much say.
They definitely do have too much say. And it's also, I mean, this is all a hangover from the Bernie days. And we know that Bernie Eccleston took the sport from being a kind of ramshackle thing in the 80s and made it into the big juggernaut it is now. But he also set it up in this weird way that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And none of it makes sense. And just having this secret agreement that they sign every 5 or 10 years, that, you know, normally, and I mean, I'm a little disappointed this year that they've agreed to it so readily, because that's normally a good 3 months of argy-bargy, and Ferrari are threatening to leave and then win. And they've all just kind of gone, yeah. Like, there was a little moment last week when Mercedes were maybe not going to sign, and then instead they've all signed. And I was looking forward to like a good few weeks of moaning.
Brad Philpott. And by the way, Brad, I just, in case you think that went unnoticed, yes, we did hear audibly the noise of your beer can rattling around in your trophy. That's right. He's using the GT trophy as a holder for his empty can of beer now.
I just wanted to say that it made me a bit sad that Ferrari retained their veto in these negotiations. So I really thought this was an opportunity. You know, we're finally with an owner of Formula One that is going to make this some kind of equitable, where, you know, the teams are, like most sports, in with an equal shout as long as they do the best job. And you've, like, finances is one thing, and finance is obviously super important in Formula One. So it's a bit of a shame if some teams get paid more than others. But the fact that you can have a rules veto is just beyond crazy in my point of view. But they obviously see Ferrari as important enough, even though they're just a midfield team now.
Bradley Philpott, we've been talking about your GT racing. We have an opportunity to watch it. Can you point us to your YouTube stream? I know you don't like it when I point out the channel's name, so I won't say that it's Brad Dude 2K. But what should we do to find that particular clip? It's on your Twitter, isn't it?
Yeah, so this is the opportunity to do some self-promotion.
Do it.
Yeah, so you can type Brad Dude 2K on YouTube if you want, or you can just type my name, which is Brad or Bradley Philpott on YouTube, and you'll find my YouTube channel. But aside from this, I'm going to take a careful, I'm going to try and carefully promote something a bit bigger than everything else I've ever done, motorsport-wise.
What
so if you
it?
If you don't mind me saying, Spanners,
go for it.
If there's any listeners who would like to be involved in something a bit bigger, in fact, I'll just say it, the UK's biggest national motorsport, quite soon, just get in contact with me on brad@bradphilpott.com. That's more important than subscribing to my YouTube channel, because I only need a couple of moderately interested partners, and we're going to do some big stuff. So email me.
So I obviously, Brad has spoken to me, and he's underplaying it still. It's very, very exciting. He's clearly, we're not talking like crowdfunding nickels and dimes here, Brad. We're talking about if you are the kind of individual who would like to partner up with Brad for sponsorship opportunities, this is a genuine, this isn't Brad's going to be circulating around Silverstone on the Alpha live stream. No offense to them. This is genuine kind of top level exposure in motorsport. So where should they get in touch with you, Brad, if they want to seriously invest in that?
Just email brad@bradphilpott.com. It's nice and simple. And that's 1L, 1T. And yeah, like you say, Spanish, it's much better than the normal stuff that you will see on my YouTube channel. So yeah, get in touch. But thanks for that, Spanish.
No, it's all right. The thing is, I know that you're downplaying it, but when people find out what this is, people who are fans of you and enjoy hearing you on Missed Apex podcast and respect you as a driver analyst when you tell us that we're meant to turn left and right and that you're meant to open up the steering with understeer, not panic, and grip the steering wheel more into the corner and get on that throttle. People who respect you as a racing driver will be delighted should this come off. Terry Saunders, thank you so much for joining us here on Missed Apex podcast. I know it's slumming it. We've not even offered you a drink, but we can offer you the opportunity to engage with our audience and send our listeners over to where you are on the internets and the stuff you do.
Yes. Well, it's fine not offering me a drink. I've been drunk the whole time.
Excellent.
And it's ff1s.com, or search podcast things for Formula One's sake, and then we're there. And we do a unlike you doing a podcast every Sunday after every race, we do a podcast maybe the Thursday after a race, if we can be bothered.
That's generous. I've seen them come out like during practice sessions for the next race.
We've occasionally just skipped a race. No one notices.
But you guys, you like edit it and everything. It's like, on it. Right, okay. Genuine compliment here. Your final audio production, when it's obviously been edited to death and produced properly, is some of the slickest, you know, non-TV radio F1 content out there. So please extend that to your producers and to your fellow cohorts. I think it's a fantastically well-made show.
Will do. And also, I should also plug, someone in the chat has just reminded me to plug, I've done these videos for Carfection, these are on YouTube. If you search YouTube Carfection, you'll find some videos of me doing Formula One-based stuff.
Brilliant. I'll tell you what we'll end on, Matt. Let's end on party mode. Why is it the end of the party in qualifying? Oh, in fact, don't answer that yet. I want to congratulate myself on how Sandy Toksvig that was. I sounded like I was from the news quiz then. Okay, I love that. Carry on.
Right, so party mode, as everybody knows, is that special mode that you dial up for your last lap or two in third session of qualifying that makes the car go stupidly fast. Stupider fast than at any other time during the weekend. And so stupidly fast that perhaps over an entire weekend, you might only get 5 total laps with that mode engaged in order to make the engine last that long. And by engine, of course, I mean power unit, because they're not called engines anymore because they're more complex than that. And that is at the root of this problem. Our friends Ferrari, who, without ever having done anything wrong that could be entirely proved, have nonetheless signed an agreement with the FIA and explained how one might go about doing all sorts of wrong things that couldn't be measured by the current FIA rules, have also gotten involved on the electrical side. The FIA has become concerned enough that they've asked for 3D scans of the electrical circuits and for all of the circuit diagrams. And what they've decided is that the root of this problem is they've allowed the engine manufacturers too much leeway when we talk about things that they call engine maps. Now, engine maps control a wide variety of parameters that I can read to you right now, but I won't because I see the look on your face.
Well, no, I don't want to be rude to our guest. I'm sure Terry wants to hear all the parameters of the engine thing.
Yes, okay. Please.
Fuel flow, air volume, boost pressure, combustion phasing, injection time, switching speed, fuel temperature, pressure in the pneumatic valve system, crankcase, oil pressure, wastegate valve timing, MGUH working time, and control of the power measured on the output shaft would be amongst the things that are controlled by the singular engine map. And they have multiple maps for different situations. And this, potentially the FIA think, is putting them out of the driver driving the car alone and unaided at all times, which they don't ever really do.
No.
But it's become a convenient catch-all when they think things are getting a bit out of hand. So, yes?
Well, I think the most interesting point coming out of this is, should we nerf teams, and that's a bit of a gaming term, isn't it? Should we deliberately hobble teams who are exploiting a regulation well? So, Brad, if there is a team that is really, really good in qualifying, and I believe Mercedes have been, you know, like nearly a second out ahead in some races, should we nerf them? Should we go, right, you did really well with that, with that, which we didn't realize, so let's change the regulations? Or, like I want to do to you, or have done to you at karting events, I've made you carry an additional 20 kilograms of weight to see if we could actually just get past you.
I'm not a big fan of mid-season regulation changes because the whole point of a sport is to see who does the best job within a given set of regulations. And to then change the rules in the middle of the sport, in the middle of the season, just seems a bit unfair, regardless of how well a team's doing. And I'm, you know, unlike some podcasts, which just slag off races which aren't super exciting, I'm happy to sit and watch the less exciting races and see like the deeper soap opera within that, you know, look at the smaller teams, look at the other stories that are evolving and be happy that within reason, the best team have won, the people that have done the best job. So yeah, I'm not a big fan of this, although fortunately, I actually don't think it's going to make a massive amount of difference. So I think it's going to be fine.
Okay. But if football was a game where you could have the amount of players on the pitch based on how much money you could spend on buses to bring them there, and Mercedes, you know, the Mercedes football team found a way to bring 100 players on the pitch and they were regularly and routinely playing Watford with 7 players, I would be in favour of finding a way to take away Mercedes' buses, you know. So I don't know, Terry, success ballast. Should we hobble teams that are doing too well?
Well, it's just, the thing is, party mode probably should have gone years ago, but yeah. I agree with Brad entirely that this shouldn't have been a mid-season change. This should be a rule change they got rid of a while ago. Success ballast, oh, it's such a horrible thing. And the whole balance of power thing, it's always going to feel a bit of a bad taste in your mouth, isn't it? You don't really want it. But also, maybe they should just make the other teams better. Instead of hobbling the best team, make the other teams better by the rules. That's the way to do it.
The opposite of what you said earlier when you talked about being jealous of Miss Apex's perceived success. Surely.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, let's drag Mercedes down.
That means that we get. But if we can keep you where you are, but we overtake through some nefarious rule changes mid-season, I'm fine with that.
Changes in the iTunes algorithm. I don't know. To some extent, Matt, Formula One has always done this. We have always had success ballast in Formula One. You just approach it in a more political way. And I think, like Brad says, you do it in a regulation change. You do it mid-season. You don't go, blimey, they're a bit good. You know that thing you develop that makes you really good? Nope. Stop it.
Well, the issue is, as you point out, historically, Formula One has done exactly this to teams. They've banned Frick for Mercedes. They've banned mass dampers for Lotus. This is not an unusual tactic, but why we're seeing it in mid-season instead of at the conclusion of a season, which might make more sense, is because much like Ferrari were rumored to have worked out how to deliver more fuel than the fuel sensor could account for,
nice
around
way.
The timing of the fuel sensor, they suspect something similar is being done with the electrical system. So this isn't merely a case of someone's been clever. It's a case of someone's figured out how to evade the current measuring systems on the car. And this is a technical directive, not a regulation, important difference. This is a technical directive aimed at eliminating the advantage some teams might have had by making that method work. And we know, for example, on a qualifying lap, they might leave the wastegate open, use the battery to run the turbo the whole lap, and then use the MGUH to provide the missing power that you would normally get from the MGUK. There are all kinds of tricks. For example, in Formula E, Scarbs posited that they were using a planetary gear and the crankshaft of a motor as a kinetic flywheel to store energy. Nissan was. Their engine was outlawed by this. And it could be that a team is up to something similar to that. So basically what Formula One is saying, this is so complicated with the software, we cannot adequately regulate it. So we are going to make you simplify what you do to a level that we do feel we have control over. And that's really where this is coming from. Now, whether it's a good idea to do it, and there are still going to be some exceptions, and really only until the last power unit is introduced will we see the kind of parity that they're talking about, all remains to be seen.
Yep, I was definitely following all of that and definitely paying attention. You can quiz me on it. Oh, no, you can't. We're out of time completely. We've got one award, of course, to give out, which is Comment of the Week for our live stream participants. And Terry will be our judge. So you have to pay attention here, Terry, because you will be you'll be the judge of the best comment. Brad?
We rename it Man of the Match of Commenting.
Wow.
So that's an FF1S reference again. They have this thing called Man of the Match of Driving, which is hilarious.
And also sexist. I cannot possibly condone anything like that, Terry. I find that disgraceful. It is Person of the Match.
So you're right. It should be Man of the Woman of the Match of Driving.
Exactly. Brad Philpott. You can basically search Bradley Philpott anywhere, and we will find you on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. On Instagram, you just post exclusively pictures of you and your trophies in interesting situations. So here's me feeding the ducks with a trophy. Here's me with a different trophy on a roller coaster.
I do use Instagram to remember how many races I've won or where they were. And the answer is 14 in a row, the most recent count. But no, it's normally pictures of nice scenery and my cats and that kind of thing.
And you can follow Terry Saunders at Terry Saunders on Twitter. Mostly, though, on Twitter, it is shopping trolley reviews where you test out robustness, capacity, and general drivability around various supermarkets.
Absolutely, yes. And it's been an exhaustive test, but so far, I think by the end of the year, we're going to have three different trolleys mapped. And looking forward to the winner.
It's only a matter of time before you enter your own trolley and supermarket into that game.
I mean, with my racing pedigree, I'm going to get a cracked rib or something, so I'm going to just leave the racing to the experts.
Oh my God. Terry Saunders attended a missed Apex karting event and slightly touched a barrier and got a slight owie
I span on a lap when I wasn't even trying to go very quick because I'd had enough, to be honest. And I span so hard. The visor came off the helmet. Has this ever happened to you, Brett? Have you ever had a visor come off a helmet? No. And my glasses went up into the helmet, and I thought I'd gone blind.
Okay, that's quite funny.
I honestly did. Yeah. So I stopped and went, I can't see.
So Phil with the wrong amount of L's on your show, actually really decent, really fast.
He's good.
Carter.
Yeah.
Chica, a little bit off the pace, but very consistent as well. You were like, you should have accidentally been on the track more than you were. You were like lawn mowing, you were into barriers. Were you just not paying attention? I don't understand. But the thing is, your throttle was constantly on the floor, despite your obvious lack of karting talent.
I have the kind of Nigel Mansell school of bravery and the Terry Saunders school of driving skill. Because I think I do show how talented drivers can be,
exactly.
Because I thought I could probably just wing it, and it turns out you can't just wing it. You've got to know like stupid things like when to brake, when to accelerate, when to steer. I just thought I'd kind of have a feel for it, but Apparently not.
No, you definitely didn't. I don't want to end on this bad note because I really like you guys. I think you're a fantastic podcast, even if you are the worst F1 podcast karting team. I genuinely hope you'll come and come do some karting with us all again soon when we can.
No.
Wow.
No, it hurt too much. No,
normally, sorry. On this kind of thing, you do kind of like a media, of course you will, and then blow us off later.
No.
You've broken like some serious etiquette. We're technically colleagues, Terry.
Yeah, I know. But it really, I can't stress how much that bruised rib hurt.
It's bruised rib now. At least you admit it. It wasn't broken. Good.
It was never broken. It was cracked. I looked it up. It
cracked.
2 weeks for a bruised rib to heal. 6 weeks for a broken rib to heal, 4 weeks for a cracked rib. It took me 4 weeks.
There you go. You reckon it was cracked? The real truth is,
I don't reckon
brave,
it was cracked.
But 3 days later, he was essentially resurrected to talk about his F1 experience. Matt, we've got an award here, and it's Comment of the Week.
Comment of the Week.
Okay, here's how it goes. I give Matt some strict criteria of the type of comment and the number of comments he should pick as nominees for Comment of the Week. He ignores that. We get bored. But when you wake up, Terry, you need to pick a winner. So, Matt, who are our nominees for Comment of the Week?
Well, at first, as I discussed earlier, we'll mention Mark Greenhow and iHammer for donating in the Super Chat. Thank you very much.
We love money. You can also support us at patreon.com/missedapex.
Indeed, you can. Our first potential winner is Clutch Botherer 2020, a.k.a. Rich Malden. Hope Brad is going to put in a clutch performance tonight, which Terry won't get unless he knows that Brad's clutch went out on lap 5 of his race, which makes his almost win, which turned into a win after a penalty, even that much more impressive.
Quick one, Brad. A clutch went on my 50cc motorcycle once, but the engine had that little grunt that I could just about just shove it into gear. In a Lotus, that feels a bit more difficult.
Yeah, so I'd never had this before. I just had to like wing it a bit and push the gear stick in harder. Now you basically have to do like heel and toe, but just without the clutch part of that. So normally you press the clutch and you'd be braking, and that's why you're downshifting. So you'd be braking, you'd press the clutch as you blip the throttle and move the gear lever into the next gear simultaneously. I just had to do that without the clutch bit. So if you do watch my onboard, you just see my left foot sat there redundant with nothing to do as I'm like, blip it. The reason this is a problem is because when you're braking, you're trying to slow down. So blipping the throttle without disengaging the engine by pressing the clutch means you're kind of speeding up as you're also trying to slow down. But you have to do it to just take the tension off the engine so the gear can come out into the next one.
Yeah.
But you also have to slam it in really hard. Long story short, my left hand hurts a lot from banging the gears.
I was going to say, how's your engine? How's the gearbox?
Fortunately, I don't own it. So and it wasn't my fault. The clutch broke. So I was of the attitude of just want to get to the end, really. Just keep smashing it in.
Fair enough. And don't worry, the people who are investing in his new future motorsport project, he definitely won't use that investment just to crunch gearboxes all the way to GT glory. Matt, next nominee.
Our friend iHammer is in with F1 is like sex. It was much more dangerous in the olden days.
Okay, that's good. That's a family-friendly one. Good, carry on.
Matt W404, if 60-year-old Kimi Räikkönen can do it, i.e. drive a Formula One car, how hard can it be?
Good. Okay, good.
And of course, the comment you referenced has to be up. It's a good thing Jensen has made friends with lots of people, lots of next generation F1 Brits soon.
Yeah, that he definitely was talking about kissing lots of pretty ladies. Matt's edited that comment quite a bit. Any more nominees?
I have three more if we have the time.
God, no, and never. That's never okay. Jeez, well, whatever, fine. Go for it. Quickly.
You didn't give me a number ahead of time, so I just read them in order that I captured them.
Okay, it's never eight. Just spoiler for the future, it's never eight. Okay, just say them quickly, I won't interrupt. Spit them out and Terry can pick one of the last
seven. Three. Thank you very much. Seven.
Fine.
All right, Mark Greenhow, getting in on the aforementioned comment. Jensen button, Benson button, tension button, mention button, Inson button, Hansen button, ransom button, Damson button. Which is like mildly amusing. I can see some amusement in Brad's face. Michael Diestelhoff in with a pun. Bradley Hola Ring at Spanners. Yeah, Brad likes that one. And
Hola,
finally,
Hola being the German word for hell, like green hell, clothing brand. Anyway, yeah, it's an in-joke.
You get it. And finally, Mark Greenhow in one more time for, of course, he knew the belts were off, referencing Charles Leclerc. The light on the dash and the annoying beeps would have told him.
Terry, can you pick us a winner?
I was going to go for the sex because I thought that would be most uncomfortable, but I'm actually going to go for the beeping seatbelt final comment because that's funny. That's quite funny because there should be a... I've always said that the Formula One should have a dashboard with lots of little lights and an oil change thing come up and a horn.
There we go. Little beeping seatbelt sound. Good. So that is the winner. Who said that comment, Matt?
Our friend Mark Greenhow.
Comment of the week.
Mark Greenhow, of course, is one of our iRacing participants. If you are an iRacing sim racer, get in touch with us, spannersready@gmail.com or missedapexpodcast@gmail.com. Come and get involved in our leagues. Our next series of Formula Renault 2.0 is going to be starting in the next few weeks when the next iRacing regular season comes to an end. You can follow us. You can email us anytime, actually, spannersready@gmail.com. You can also follow the show at Missed Apex F1. We've got a Facebook group. We've got all that good stuff. Follow my panel, please, Matt at MattPT55. Search for Brad Philpott and search for our special guest, Terry Saunders. Last word of the podcast goes to Terry Saunders. Now, Terry, you are a professional comedian, or at least you were. You have history in comedy. I've been trying to teach my kids about kind of, you know, pacing and timing of comedy and when a joke's gone too far. You must absolutely die inside when middle-aged pundits are going up to Lando Norris or Max Verstappen and trying to reference the cool things they said on their stream.
Yeah, there's something. It's just let the boys be boys and just go back to talking about the 90s. That's all we need. We don't just let the streams are, yeah. The stream is a place for where the streamers go. Let them stay there. And if you want to join, then fine.
Yeah, don't ask about milk because it's becoming increasingly uncomfortable.
Yeah, I don't even know because I don't watch the streams because I'm old, where the milk thing came from. But it I don't feel like it's translating well into Sky Sports coverage where they're just covering a car with milk. And just, all I can think of when I watched that thing, if you saw it when they just had a bucket of milk in the car with the two of them driving around, is that car's going to stink. Like in a couple of days, and whoever they've hired that car off, they're going to get it back at the dealership and be like, what happened? Oh, you've had Lando Norris driving your car. Yeah, there's a slight
problem. They won't get it. They won't get it.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Terry Saunders. Go subscribe to his podcast for F1's sake. My recommendation for after a race is come to us for a live stream or listen to us on your Monday morning commute. And then several weeks later, when they also do their review, do check it out. Even if it's the last week's review, it's just good podcasting for F1's sake. You can catch us here again. The next time we'll be streaming will be our review of the Belgian Grand Prix. So join us at 8 p.m. The night of the review, and we'll be here with a panel talking about the race. And then on Tuesday, we're going to have Matthew Carter here, and we're going to do a deep dive of the Williams situation, as well as, you know, as we normally do, talking about some of his insights as a former Formula One team boss. And that evening, the 1st of September, Tuesday, 7 p.m. UK time, you can buy a ticket for a virtual live audience with Joe Saywood, hosted by Missed Apex Podcast. So go to missedapexpodcast.com/Joe to buy your tickets. Wherever we see you next, be brave, because wounds heal, chicks dig scars, and glory lasts forever. This was Missed Apex. That's not bad, Matt. You know, at the 57-minute mark, I was going, right, let's just wrap this up. Let's do it. We can just wrap this up. But then, I don't know, that feels just like the conversation's just getting going by then.
Yeah, I wanted to say thanks for including the party mode band, because that comes in at Monza, and it was being referenced in the chat room. There was some other interesting stuff that our friend Joe talked about.
Yeah.
But we'll have to save that for another show now, won't we?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.